Okay, this is Elizabeth Simonson interviewing Bob Hewitt. Bob Hewitt, November 5th, 1998. And we're in the presence of your paintings right now, and I'm feeling very torn about where to begin because this is really exciting and you're here at Hunter again. And but I kind of feel I'd like to start chronologically and maybe ask you, when did you start to realize that you might want to be an artist, and how did that all come about?
Well, I have to start with actually my family. I have to begin at the beginning. And my name is a French-Canadian name. And my father's father did it and ran. He never knew his father. But his mother was a very talented woman, very bright and talented, a wonderful musician, terrific pianist. And my father was also a talented musician and a fine singer. He's a very skilled baritone, and though an amateur, nonetheless very talented and very skilled in his ability to do things. He's an electrician, electrical engineer without credentials, didn't have a college education. And he was very athletic and a very attractive man. Mm-hmm. And he married my mother, who was one of eight children, a Scottish family. And so I'm actually second generation, really. Mm-hmm. And my mother's family, her father was an amateur musician also, a blacksmith, mm-hmm. an inventor, and a great reader, and an alcoholic, and a fighter. And so I have this sort of background of people who knew how to do things and did things.
Right.
So when I was a child, my sister and I used to, I'm one of two children, I'm the oldest, my sister is 4 years younger, and each Sunday, from as far back as I can remember, we'd either go to one grandparent's home or the other, and when we were at my father's mother's home, she played and he sang, and my sister and I would sing back up uh-huh. to them, you know, yeah. for, you know, religious songs and semi-popular songs and that sort of. So I had this musical training, you know, informally but good. Mm-hmm. And I drew. My mother was a very talented woman in that she was a skilled homemaker. She made clothing. She did the wallpapering. She made her own clothes and, you know, made slip covers for the furniture and had a sense of decoration. And
she was made to work with her hands.
To work with her hands, although she was, you know, also, well, not that these are mutually exclusive, quite the opposite, but she was very intelligent and very, I would say, really, in a certain sense, the more dominant personality of the two. Mm-hmm. My father, though he was in no way a wimp or anything, mm-hmm. she was really the, you know, kind of the leader, uh-huh. as it were. You know. And she had her own, she wanted, when she was very young, she wanted to be a writer also. Mm-hmm. And so she was exceedingly talented. So, in a certain sense, I grew up in this home situation, this family situation, where you know, the arts were present, although not in a high art
right,
way.
But just incorporated in your daily life and all around. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I was interested in. I mean, I come across this a lot when I was doing my research on. You and you spoke about this once before when we talked on the phone, that object color notion you had as a child. I think that's so interesting and wonderful. tell about that, how you started.
Yeah, when I was, I drew and made things from, as far back as I can remember. And when I was a child, 8 years old or whatever, my father gave me, partial cans of paint that were really house paint. Mm-hmm. But, there were a variety of colors, not necessarily the brightest, but, there were greens and reds and whites and yellows and blacks. And I got into painting my toys. And I became very involved with that. And I would paint these objects. And if it wasn't the right color, I would repaint it. Mm-hmm. So I very early on had what I call this sense of what I called object color. That each object had an intrinsic correct color for its shape or its function or whatever, so that this ambulance should be white, this airplane should be red and silver, this tank should be olive green, this truck should be black or yellow or whatever seemed correct to me. So very early on, I had a very strong sense of color, not just color, but it's how it functioned in its structure, in its form. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think was just a symptom. Of my involvement, and it was formative, certainly, but it was a very rich experience for me. Mm-hmm. And thinking back on it, it just fits,
Yeah.
And so,
Well, I know I'm talking ahead, but that whole idea reminds me of your much later work, like with the Paula Cooper Gallery and the painting the room, that eggshell blue. That seems to me like a connected situation, like that's that completely matured and realized. But we'll get back to that, surely.
Yeah.
But then how did you get connected with Hunter or maybe even before that, when did you start to think of yourself as maybe an artist?
Well, I don't know. When I was a kid, more into maybe, probably not that old, but say 11 or 12 years old, there was an older woman. Her name was Mrs. Canada. Mm-hmm. And she was an artist. Mm-hmm. And she lived in town. And she painted, I guess, what we would think of as somewhat conventional paintings, portraits, and still life paintings. But she was good. And so my mother talked to her and asked her if I could, have some lessons, So I would go to Mrs. Canaday's studio. She had a little studio, which was really kind of in a basement, but it was not a deep basement, so it had windows looking outside. And she would set up a still life and sort of a Chianti bottle and a rose, which of course didn't interest me at all. Mm. But nonetheless, I went through the ritual of drawing these with pastel colored chalk. And, I actually, some of those are still around, somewhere. I think my sister may have some of those early pastel drawings. So I had a little taste of, quasi-formal training, but I was not, I wanted to draw, planes and tanks and war and explosions, like kids, because I was a kid. I was not, but I, but I loved drawing figures. And my mother bought me a book of reproductions of Michelangelo, mm-hmm. his, you know, sculpture and his drawings. And from, I don't know, 12, I started copying Michelangelo, but I also copied, you know, Varga girls, you know what they were? Mm-hmm. Petty girls, they were calendar art. These were artists who drew babes, you
uh-huh.
know.
Oh,
you
right.
know,
and was this related to the war at all?
No. They were just you know, like, you know, like calendars for guys.
Yes.
You know, that, you know,
yeah.
sex.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, babes with boobs
yeah.
and cute bottoms. And
uh-huh.
So I would draw those also.
Uh-huh.
So it, I had no, I didn't differentiate between Michelangelo and pop, I guess,
mm-hmm.
really pop art,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
So I would copy Varga girls and Petty girls and Michelangelo all with the same sort of enthusiasm,
uh-huh.
Which in a way I think was good because though I guess some people might categorize the kind of work that we do as maybe high art,
mm-hmm.
I never felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
I take my art very seriously and I take art seriously,
yeah.
but I've never liked those kinds of distinctions. If I like the way a car looks or the way somebody's graffiti looks
mm-hmm.
or, you know, a commercial design looks or a shoe looks
mm-hmm.
or a, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The side of a bus or a truck or an airplane or I don't care. It's just food for me as a visual artist. I'll take anything.
And it shows in what you've done with your career and the different material you've worked with. And so I understand.
So that was, in a way, a really good, you know, the symptoms were there right
mm-hmm.
from the start, you know, even the, you know, starting with painting toys and household paints and the lack of making these kinds of hierarchical,
mm-hmm.
Elitist kinds of choices. I think I've always been very anti-elitist
mm-hmm.
and always a Democrat in my life. I've always tried to be and always tried to be fair and treat everyone equally, and I, you know, I always say, you know, like anyone that I, whether it's, you know, a poor son of a bitch laying in the gutter or whatever, there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in God, but
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
I see myself in everyone, you know.
Right. And well, how would you say? I mean, I know I'm hopping ahead here, but it seems to be a good time to talk about your teaching with that kind of attitude, because I know that you've often, you know, something I read that you had said that you felt that artist's role was as a teacher in some respect. And do you, when you dealt with students and all of that, how do you feel like this equal idea worked into that?
Well, okay, that's a complex question. Yeah, we are jumping ahead. I'd like to...
Do you want to wait on that?
No, I'll talk to that, but then I want to go back.
Okay.
When I was first hired at Hunter, I was hired as an instructor. But I always felt more comfortable with the title of instructor than
uh-huh.
professor.
Yeah.
As the teacher, I am the one who's running the class. I am number one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the boss.
Mm-hmm.
But my purpose is not for the sheer exercise of power, but rather to create a situation where each person, each student, has the opportunity to explore his or her ideas and his or, you know, himself or herself. So my thought was always to If it were a situation where you, say in the 101 class, for example, the introductory class, I would try to create problems that were simultaneously specific, but also open to interpretation, so that you as a student would have a direction, but you would also have the opportunity to take it and make it your own. So I think that, in a very brief way, that would be one of the symptoms of the way I would approach it. Yeah, because, I never wanted to create little Bob Hewitts at all.
Right. So you sort of saw yourself more as just a facilitator.
In a way.
But yet the one that was sort of kind of setting up the parameters for them to...
And also demanding respect for not just for me, but for the subject at hand. This is not bullshit. This is not play. Art is serious, and if you're going to be in here, you're going to work. And you're going to take this seriously. You're going to take yourself seriously. Because it's out of respect for yourself that you embrace this.
Yeah. Well, so then let us back up and get into
how did you get to Hunter?
How did you get to Hunter?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. When I we'll jump ahead to college. By that time, I obviously was making art. I was painting and drawing. But in my family, even though there was this integration of art into life, the idea of being an artist was non-existent. As a vocation, as an avocation, as an amateur phenomenon, yes, but not to be an artist.
Right.
So when I went to school, I studied chemistry, and I was very good at chemistry when I was in high school. In fact, my favorite teacher was Mr. Greenslade. Was this great big red-headed guy with a glass eye. He was quite a character. When I took high school chemistry, I reinvented ignorantly what was called the Pauli exclusion theory, which was the notion that it was about the attraction of the nucleus to the electrons, the relationship of the electron rings to the nucleus. So I spoke about this as a kid. So I was very into it. And I had no knowledge of the Pauli exclusion theory. I just came upon it through my own thinking process. So, and Mr. Greenslade was this big guy, and he was, we had a couple of football players in the class, and one kid's name was Carchetti. He said, "Carchetti, hit him in the back of the head, how many fingers am I holding up, if he fell asleep or didn't pay attention, So he was a guy, and I thought, here's someone I can identify with. Here's a man of, with intellect, and so I identified with him, and so that was my attraction to chemistry, in addition to being good at it. And in fact, I got my degree in chemistry and worked as a pigment chemist. And I was working, making my paintings anyway. I was, when I still lived on with my family on Staten Island in the cellar, I had my easel and my, making my paintings. And then I went to Wagner College and studied chemistry, and while I was there, I met the art teacher. We had one art teacher. And in the art room, there was one room, and everything went on in there, painting, drawing, ceramics, And this guy's name was Tom Young, and he was part of the 10th Street scene, and he showed at the March Gallery, and he was pals with Franz Klein, and I used to go with him when I was a teenager to the Cedar Bar, and hang out with Klein and Lance Lewitton. And
now at that time, with Klein, was he sort of in his?
His glory days. He was. He was one of the princes
superstars.
Of art.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But he was very accessible, mm-hmm. not a very friendly, great talker, mm-hmm. and loved to hang out and be with people and talk, mm-hmm. and treated me. I mean, not that I was his big friend or anything, but treated me as a guy. Mm-hmm. We used to close down the Cedar Bar and then go to Riker's around the corner and have coffee and eggs at mm-hmm. 5 a.m. We were still talking.
Yeah.
And for I was like 19 years old, and I knew I was an artist.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew it. And then not too long after that, I was drafted into the Army. And when I was in the Army, I decided that, hi, Toinette, how are you? This is, Elizabeth, this is Toinette Tharp Garvey. Well, that part, period.
Period.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Elizabeth and I are doing an interview. So
go ahead and I'll
walk
I'm
around.
Yeah.
And Jesse will be along.
There's a lot of pain, too, than I expect. I can't believe how much work you do.
I'm a hard worker. So anyway, I was drafted, and I served a couple of years. And while I was in the Army, we had a house off base. Mm-hmm. And even though we showed up for formation every morning, and they didn't know about it, we had a house, and I had a studio. So when I was in the service, I had my own studio off base and painted. And I decided that when I got out, I would go to Hunter, because Motherwell at that time was teaching at Hunter. But when I got to Hunter, he was gone, and Fritz Bultmann was teaching painting. And Ray Parker put me into Fritz's painting class. I came up, and I didn't really have the credits, but Ray put me in the class anyway.
Did you know Ray before?
I didn't know him.
Oh,
I knew of his painting.
He was just your first contact.
He was a teacher here.
Yeah.
And he had registration duty
night. The advisor.
He was the advisor.
Yeah, okay.
And so I went up to him, and I said, well, I'd really like to get into some painting. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take a painting class. And he said, okay, I'll put you in Fritz's class.
Now I was a little unsure of this. Now, the undergrad was still all women, right, at this point? And the graduate was co-ed?
The graduate was always co-ed, and there was what's now Lehman College was part of Hunter, and they had men up there in engineering and that sort of thing up there. But shortly after the end of the Korean War, I think, I can't recall exactly the date, but it began to become coeducational. But you're right, originally it was a normal school, mm-hmm. and most of the women teachers in the city school system got their education at Hunter College.
Right, yeah.
And it was a great school, and obviously still is. It's mm-hmm. the best mm-hmm. college in the university. Although at that time, well, maybe it had begun to change. At one time, City College was the preeminent college.
Oh, okay.
But now it's Hunter.
Yeah, I agree.
But anyway, I got into Fritz's painting class. Then I got into George Sugarman's sculpture class. Mm-hmm. So I had two really terrific artists as teachers. And then and incidentally, it must be said that though I think Gene Goosen really gave the department its, brought it to its high plateau. Mm-hmm. I think that Edna Lutz was the one who really started it.
Right.
And she's the one that hired Reinhardt, Baziotis, and I think Parker also. She hired those.
And so when you started, hadn't Goosen just started as
chair? He came after I was a student. Yeah, I studied in the graduate department for a year or so. Then I decided that if I was going to make it as an artist, the degree was not going to do it for me.
Right.
So I decided I wouldn't get a degree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I began to show, and Goosen hired me.
I see. Oh, yeah. So then by 63 you were starting.
I was hired at 63.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he hired me. And because I had begun to show, and, you know, I actually a guy that taught here, William Rubin, who became the curator of painting and sculpture at the Modern,
yeah.
He started to buy my paintings in 63.
Yeah.
So suddenly, you know, things started.
You were getting a lot of, I mean,
I was getting some attention.
Yeah,
yeah,
I mean, like, when did you leave the Army? 58 or 59?
60.
And then, that's pretty good.
Yeah, but I've been painting for.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like
a long, I wasn't, yeah. You know, and I wasn't one of these people who was pushing myself, really. I was always invited to show. I never pushed myself.
And at this time, with the program, were you in a situation where you had your studio and when you were working with Fritz Bolt?
Oh, yeah, I had a studio.
And they would come to your studio?
Well, they didn't. Listen, when Fritz came to my studio, it wasn't like the program they had here.
Okay.
It was like someone honoring me. Yeah, that's right. And
yeah.
When he came, it was like one of the great moments of my life that Fritz Boltman came to my studio,
right.
My lowly, humble studio to see my work. You
uh-huh.
know, it was like, oh man, you know, I mean, this is a great honor.
Yeah.
You know? I don't think the students here respect it at all.
Well, it's so different now. I
yeah.
mean, and then, you know, the school.
I think they think we're assholes.
Well, I want to ask you what you think about. Since, just real briefly, if you could compare what it was like for you as a student at Hunter and what you think it's like for us now. I mean, because
it is different, and I don't really want to talk about
okay.
that because I don't feel, yeah, I would prefer not to,
okay.
to make those judgments. I can simply say for me that art was my life, period, and I lived for art. That was what I
mm-hmm.
lived for. And I supported myself as a pigment chemist.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in a pigment factory. And then I would, you know, then I would come and study,
mm-hmm.
or I painted,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I went to every opening, every party, every art event.
Mm-hmm.
I just, and, you know, slept maybe 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then like about January, I collapsed for a month, really,
mm-hmm.
and lay in bed and recuperate and
yeah.
start this over again for
yeah.
another year.
Yeah.
And that's the way I lived, and I just lived art. That
yeah.
was what I lived for, and I didn't have any thought of being a teacher or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
but I knew I was going to have to be my own patron. I was going to have a job
mm-hmm.
that would pay for my studio and my food,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't looking to anyone to support me.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was going to be me, and that was okay because I knew that I could do what I wanted to do. I didn't
right.
owe anyone anything. And if someone had said to me that I would be a professor, you know, in the City University for 30 years at that time, I would have said,
yeah.
You know, the idea of it never crossed my mind. I had a very, since I was a kid, I had this idea. I grew up on Staten Island, and we lived in Oakwood Heights, and about a mile from the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, we went to the beach all summer, and, you know, when I was old enough, I would do it myself. I'd get on my bike and ride down to the beach and stay there
mm.
forever, you know?
Yeah.
Well, during the summer, anyway, with my friends and hang out. And, my idea was to have a little beach bungalow on stilts down there, because it used to flood, you know,
yeah.
a little bungalow, and do my painting, and have my junky car and a little rowboat, maybe,
mm-hmm.
and paint and have parties with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
That was That's what I, you know, that was my ambition, you know,
right.
Very modest. And so what has come of my life for me is quite amazing and wonderful.
You know? Yeah, and in a way you sort of, I don't want to hop ahead, but we keep, like, in a way you kind of got that when you moved upstate, I would think, in obviously it's on a beach,
yeah.
But it's that going off, and this is my air, this is my place, this is, I'm going to do my work here regardless of what's happening out there in the market and the art community and all of that. And before we get to that decision in your life, when you decided to do that, could we talk a little bit about your involvement with, like, the Art Workers Coalition and what you and Robert Morris did together with some of the performance work? Because how did you meet him?
We were students together.
You were students together.
Yeah, he got out of the service at about the same time I did.
Uh-huh.
And we were in Richard Lippold's design class together. And, you know, Richard Lippold was a very intelligent, elegant, sort of gay man, and very witty and sarcastic and arrogant. And if you were an asshole, he'd beat the shit out of you verbally, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he was relentless if you made a fool of yourself. And Morris and I would, when he gave these problems, Morris would come up with the most sophisticated solution, you know, but it, and of course it was gray at that time,
yeah.
Right? And I would come up with 30 or 40 solutions to it. And I'd say, well, what about this? 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 Just, you know, inundate him with his, you know, dippy idea, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like, so we were very aggressive. But, you know, we played the game, we played the rules, and we did the work like we did. You know, we just did, I mean, I'd come in with a box full of solutions each time, you know, 20, 30 solutions to each problem, you know, and so Morris would come in with some really elegant piece, you know, and so we got to be friends, and but very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided we would do a piece together at the Judson for, you know, a series of performance and dance events that they were doing. And well, some of the people were Yvonne Rainer and Carolee Schneeman and peripherally Rauschenberg was sort of hovering around, though I don't think he didn't participate in that particular series of events. Judith Dunn, Robert Dunn, Trish Brown, Lucinda Childs, people like that.
Uh-huh.
And Morris and I did a collaboration that we called War.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Lamont Young playing, providing our sound. And we each constructed suits of armor secretly from each other. We didn't, neither of us knew what the other was doing, but we each had voodoo dolls that we were, you know, sticking pins into and things, and we were psyching each other, you know, and we had a class that, I can't recall what it was about, but we went to this these people's studio, and Morris jumped me, he sneak attacked me, but I caught him and I grabbed him and I picked him up and put him up on top of the truck.
Oh my God.
And he suddenly
realized who he was doing.
Yeah, right. And so when we did the war, which was great, we stood at the either end of this, what was really a gym, and in the dark, and he got a couple of pigeons. And we each had a pigeon under our arm. And it was 3 minutes of darkness. And Lamont played this gong, you know. Gong, gong, like this, you know. The people were getting restless, right? Then suddenly the lights came up. And Morris and I released our pigeons. And they went fluttering around. And we charged towards each other. crashed together, and we had these breakable weapons, and we were smashing each other, you know, and the pieces were flying, and people were screaming, you know. And then when all of our weapons were destroyed, we grabbed each other and rolled toward the audience. And just as we reached the edge of the audience, blackout, and 3 more minutes of gong and darkness, and we snuck out, you know, and it was like, it was great.
Yeah.
And then Rauschenberg wanted us to do the piece at a thing in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, this was a one-time piece.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do it. It was one, it's a unique
event.
Yeah.
Right.
So Morris got pissed off at me about that. So we, you know, he went on and did a sort of a pseudo imitation of it down there. And, so we sort of
with another person.
Drifted. Well, I don't know. I don't really know.
Because
we sort of drifted a little apart at that time. But
you were both teaching at Hunter.
Yeah.
Right? And
well, we weren't at that time.
Oh, okay.
That was when we were students.
Okay.
He went on to get a degree in art history.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. This was in 61.
Mm-hmm.
This was 60 or, yeah, 60. January 61, I think.
Or 63, maybe?
No.
Oh,
no.
61. Okay,
yeah,
so
January 61.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, but at this point, you're starting to show now by yourself, and it's just interesting to me how quickly your work... I wasn't able to get many images of what your paintings were like, although I know more about the work as it dematerialized, so to speak,
yeah.
So that by the end, by 69, was when you were doing the Paul or Cooper.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
What was that like to be in that environment when this, I mean, this just sounds like such an exciting time.
Yeah, it was. It was very exciting. Well, when I got out of the service, I became very involved in the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was in the Continental Army Command, headquarters of the armies in the United States, and I worked in what was called material development.
Mm-hmm.
And we were making things, wonderful things like the Claymore Mine,
mm-hmm.
all these nice things to kill people with. You
yeah.
know? And we knew about the U-2 flights, we knew about the advisors, American so-called advisors in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were taking on the French colonialists' job, you know.
Right.
And you know, very soon as that began to happen, that is, the anti-Vietnam War, you know, movement began to materialize, and, you know, I was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, and, you know, we started the Art Workers Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And
were your students, or did they get involved with that at all, or did you talk about it with them?
Well, in my work as a teacher, I tried not to push what I did on
mm-hmm.
people. You know,
right.
I tried to keep my own art. I never showed my art or talked very much about myself to my students
mm-hmm.
because I didn't want to unduly influence them.
Yeah.
You know? I didn't feel like that was fair. You know what I mean? I wanted them to be who they were. And
yeah,
if they took the trouble to find out about me,
yeah.
fine, but I didn't, you know, promote myself or anything like that, you know.
So they may or may not have known.
What time is it now?
Oh, it's 10:04?
Yeah. I'm just a little concerned about, you know, Toinette.
Do you want to stop?
Is it okay?
All right, let's stop. I'll stop this for a second.
So where were we? We were talking about Vietnam War, we were talking about the Art Workers Coalition.
And also about how your role as a teacher, which I really respect, and I think it's smart to not... You're right, students are very much interested in sort of being influenced by a teacher, what they are doing and what, you know, and I think that's really wise of you to have kind of left that separate. And you're right, if they wanted to find out more, they could do that.
Yeah, I mean, I was obviously not hiding out.
Mm-hmm.
I was very involved in the art world and the,
mm-hmm.
you know, the anti-war movement and the Art Workers Coalition and all of those things. And I was involved with Twyla. She and I started her dance company. We did, in fact, I was the sort of producer of artistic director and even performer in the early pieces. So that was, I guess we got together in 63 maybe, something like that. And we started her dance company in 64, and I presented her first two dances at Hunter in room 1604, which was then a beautiful little Art Deco theater designed by Edmund Lutz.
That space still exists?
Yeah, no, really, but they put a wall, they screwed it up, they put a wall in there.
No, not that. But it looked like a great space.
It was a wonderful, and you know, we would utilize the whole space, the balcony, the stage, and we did, you know, beautiful things there. And I don't know. Now maybe he did start.
He started in 62.
He started in 62. That's right.
I just was wondering if you.
But I never had him as an instructor. Okay. No. He was friendly. You know who was really close to him was Doug Olson. Doug Olson was worked for him and helped build his sculpture and so on.
Right.
So he and he was, Doug was his protege, like, for a while.
Yeah.
And but Tony, Tony and I sort of had a little attitude about each other.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and we even got almost into a fight at Donahue's one day, because I was ready to beat the shit out of him, because he was being a real asshole. He was drunk, he came in and he started pontificating and interrupted us. And I said, hey, you're interrupting us, asshole. And, because I was a bit of a, I told you about my grandfather. And I had a little of that.
Genes.
It was in my genes. That was my, I wasn't always beating people up, but I mean, I had that, a bit of that kind of street fighter personality. Sorry, but it was kind of. Tony and I respected him and thought very highly of him and went to his shows.
Right.
Considered him as a friend, but also there was, I wasn't going to kiss his ass. I felt I was his peer. I wasn't going to bow down to Tony Smith. He was just another artist,
right,
as far as I was concerned.
Tell me about in the 70s when you decided to move out of the area. You kept teaching at Hunter and Community, right?
Yeah, but I bought my farm in 1969. Yeah. Well, you know what happened was I got one of the first NEA grants for an individual artist when Henry Geltzeller was running it. And one morning, there was a check in the mail. I didn't apply for anything. There was a check. And it was during the war, and I said, oh, fuck this, I'm going to send this back. I don't want money from this corrupt government.
Right.
And somebody said to me, don't send it back. They'll just make bombs out of it. I said, oh, yeah. Okay, right. Yeah, good idea.
Yeah.
I'll put it in the bank. So I just put it in a savings account. I was not a sophisticated investor at that time, where everybody was not in the market. Which everybody is now,
Which is not good right now, but whatever.
Well, you might as well be there. But anyway, so I didn't send the money back. I stuck it in a savings account. And a number of our friends had farms, or their families did. And like I said, I grew up on Staten Island. When I was a kid, it was still country. And there were farms and wildlife and woods. And I loved the woods, and I loved being outside. And I loved that, the idea of that kind of freedom, of space, So we began to visit, at that time I was with Twyla, we were together and eventually married. And we'd go and visit. Oh, you know, she had a friend, Lou Lloyd, who was who managed. His wife was Elizabeth Lloyd, was it? She was a dancer with Merce Cunningham.
Mm.
Was that her name, Elizabeth Lloyd?
I'm not familiar with.
Barbara Lloyd.
Uh-huh.
And they had a child, Benjamin, who was a little older than Jesse. Anyway, Lou's family had a farm, and we went and visited there. And then Sandy and Jack Beale, painters, artists. She was a sculptor, he was a painter. They had a place up around Black Lake, and we visited up there. And,
mm-hmm.
Jane Kaufman, Doug Olson and Jane Kaufman bought a place out near Gene Goosen around Bennington, Vermont.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a leader on it.
Yeah.
That's without, you know, just plain plastic.
Right.
Without, so anyway, I'll just start with, again, visiting friends who had, you know, places, farms, you know, old farms. So I started to look, you know, and, I took, you know, a little while, you know,
mm-hmm.
The momentum began. It was, you know, a couple of times 1 year and then a few more times the
mm-hmm.
next year. And finally, in 69, I began to look seriously. And we had sort of decided a radius from New York of, say, 200 to 250 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to get these catalogs, you know, real estate catalogs. And I don't remember which, whether it was United Farm or another agency, but there was a, some listings for Chenango County and that area. And the real estate agent was a man named Dick Cowan. He was a great big man, and it turned out he was a veteran of the Second War and survived the Bataan Death March.
Wow.
Yeah, so quite a guy.
Huh.
Anyway, he took us around, and eventually we saw what was to be my farm. And one day we looked at three places, and then this was probably the third place.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even remember the other places.
Mm-hmm.
And he drove up onto one of the high hills on the farm. And
mm-hmm.
said, "Well, what do you think of this?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, I think it's pretty goddamn good."
Right.
So, "Well, you want to buy it?" And I said, "Yeah."
Yeah.
And it was unbelievable. It was so inexpensive. Real estate was so depressed at that time. It was,
uh-huh.
you know, five times as much as I had expected to get for that amount of money. And I fell in love with it. But sadly, Twyla really didn't want to be there. But she didn't tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of unfortunate. But
what was it like for you then to kind of pull out of the whole art scene? And I mean, from what I read, it sounded like it was beyond just I've got this farm, and I'm gonna kind of, I just can't make it back anymore. That you really kind of made a conscious decision.
Yeah.
Like,
well, part of my attitude about the anti-war movement and the whole what I saw the art world as being just simply an elite organization of shops for the ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just clowns, entertainers for the rich, you know,
mm-hmm.
which we probably still are. And I decided that I was going to stop showing and stop having any, you know, participation in this commercial art world.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously, my work was becoming more and more invisible. I was, you know, making things that were consciously basically unsalable, you
mm-hmm.
know. How can you sell a blue wall or
right.
a polyurethane floor or a shadow?
Yeah.
You know, you can't, you know. And incidentally, Kynaston McShine did a conceptual show at the Museum of Modern Art.
Mm-hmm.
And I was to be in this show, so I went up to, I was invited to go up and look around. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, there was a ladder that the workmen were using to change the lights or whatever. And mm-hmm. I said, okay, this is my piece. Mm-hmm. This ladder and its shadow.
Yeah.
And it's an anonymous piece. Oh boy, did this piss him off. But he left it up for the show and then took it down.
Uh-huh. You mean for the opening he left it up?
Yeah, for the opening and then took it away. But I was not going to shows or museums or anything. So I really couldn't say anything about it.
Right.
Because it would violate my position of anonymity, you know.
And you were at this time you were kind of working with Hollis Frampton, right?
Well, Hollis and I met, actually Carl Andre introduced us.
Oh.
And I was teaching at Hunter, and Hollis was working as a dye transfer technician.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gene Goosen went on sabbatical, and Georgia Rave was teaching here,
mm-hmm.
and she was acting as his administrative assistant. So she and I, she was setting up programs for all of the faculty. So we decided to start a photography class and a film class.
Yeah.
So she and I started photography and film in the Hunter Art Department when Goosen was on sabbatical.
Huh,
so we sort of did it subversively.
Yeah.
And we hired Hollis to teach the photography
uh-huh.
class, and I taught the
so
film
class. So that was the first time photography was being taught then?
Yeah.
And then it stuck after when he
oh,
came
yeah.
back, he was
that's
okay
right.
with it. And,
yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
So we, you know, the whole, you know, that whole, you know, photography and combined media and all of that
yeah.
came from that moment, that sort of subversive moment
yeah.
when Georgia Rave and I decided that we should have film and photography.
Right, yeah.
And so that was, and the great thing about Goosen was that he said, okay,
yeah.
you know, instead of being
close
an asshole,
yeah.
he said, well, all right, well, let's
mm-hmm.
try it,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and he went along with it,
because
mm-hmm. he could have said, what did you do that for?
Right.
Boom,
right.
you know,
yeah,
we
right.
won't have this.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He
yeah,
was
he
big enough and man enough or person enough,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't want to be sexist. Human
mm-hmm.
enough or
yeah.
big enough or broad enough, you know, intelligent enough and, you know, was not, all right, let's try it.
Yeah.
So that's the way the photography department began in the art department.
That's really great. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So, but Hollis was working, as I said, as a dye transfer technician. And he had a loft in a building on Walker Street that was actually Frank Stella was renting it
mm.
and had one floor for a studio and then another floor for storage.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hollis had the top floor for his studio. And he was hardly ever there, and he let me use his, you know, his rewinds and his,
mm-hmm.
You know, splicer and
mm-hmm.
all of that. And I began to make my films in his, you know, in his studio.
Yeah.
And he had started making films, but he'd only made a couple of films. He was doing a lot of photography work. He was making his own photographs, but he was doing a lot of art photography, like taking photos of people's work.
Mm-hmm.
And he did some of the photographs for Rosenquist
mm-hmm.
for his paintings, like, you know, like maybe there was some spaghetti in the
right.
painting. Well,
he
Hollis
made that photo,
oh, yeah, for that
okay.
image.
Uh-huh.
You know? So Hollis was doing work like that. And he had only made two films at that time. One was called Information and the other one was called Process Red. And they were good little films, but I don't even know if they're still in distribution. But then he, I think he kind of got jealous of the fact that I was using his equipment more than he was,
mm-hmm.
you know. That kind of gave him a kick in the ass. And
yeah.
But I wouldn't take any credit for what he did. I just think that
that
the idea that it could have been anyone, someone was working in there
and
cranking away, it was like, hey, I better get my ass in gear.
Yeah.
And then I got, you know, created this job for him, you know?
Yeah.
And, of course, he took it and ran with it, you know? I don't want to, you know, take any credit for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he certainly...
He certainly
had ability and intelligence and creativity and energy and, you know, was just there waiting to happen. But I'm proud that I at least had a small part in that.
I'm happy for that.
Yeah. And then he, you know, when I bought the farm, he used to come and stay at the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd help me with all kinds of work there, you know. I mean, he helped me with, you know, dragging. The place was, the place was a mess. You know? He helped me do demolition and drag out, you know, tons of garbage. The guy that lived there, when, I mean, the roof leaked. I mean, it still had 100-year-old slate roof that leaked. You know, I mean, it was falling apart. It was disintegrating, and as a ceiling would fall in one room, the guy would move to the next room, you know? So the place was, well, when I, yeah, it was a mess. When I bought it, it was strictly on the acreage. The buildings didn't even count. So I thought, oh, when I realized what I'd done, I thought, oh my God, what did I do? You know, I bought the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, and I'm gonna have to be fixing it for the rest of my life, you know? But I don't regret it.
Do you mind if we hop ahead to kind of what's happening now with your work? But I know we're skipping a pretty big
Yeah, why don't we stop?
You want to stop now?
Yeah, let's stop.